down by itself, doesn't it?
So our last session for the day, and we'll have some meditation this time. And I think at the end we can chant the text we haven't looked at yet, which is the Song of the Stages of the Path. We'll round off by studying that one, chanting that one, I mean, at the end of the meditation, I think. Right at the end of the day, then dedicate the merits, if we remember. So we finish at 5. Right, so we'll just read a little bit more of the text and leave some for tomorrow. But we've got to get this a broad understanding of the question of suffering here, yeah. So there's a feeling of suffering, and then there's the objects that give rise to suffering. You know, then there's suffering, and there's the truth of suffering. So there are many sort of distinctions that are getting made here, so we have to sort of sort them out. And that, you know, something like toast and marmalade is a sort of hopefully useful example, you know, that to help us sort of make some of these distinctions, so that we can think more clearly about what Buddha's trying to say when he's saying that, you know, all of samsara is suffering, or all contaminated phenomena are suffering. What do you understand by that word contaminated then? Pardon? Yeah, we're talking about contaminated karma, and here, contaminated phenomena.
Having negative imprints.
That'll be something to do with it. But would you say the toast and marmalade, is that a contaminated phenomena then? If it's suffering, then it should be a contaminated phenomena. Or if it is a contaminated phenomena, it should be suffering then. It is suffering because it's a contaminated phenomenon. So how is toast and marmalade a contaminated phenomenon? Does that contaminate the phenomena? Do the flowers get contaminated by the way I'm looking at them? That's... doesn't alter their nature. I mean, I might have some superimpositions, but... yeah, that can be one way of looking at it. They're contaminated in that they will, you know, in the ordinary being, they give rise to these afflicted minds, such as attachment. So... phenomena like that. So you wouldn't say the Buddha's form body or something like that. You wouldn't say that's contaminated. But when we use the word contaminated karma, what do we mean by contaminated there? I always think it means, you know, it's karma which is created by in the motivation to do that particular action. Then there are afflicted minds. There is some kind of disturbed emotion, negative emotion like attachment or anger, or else some other type of afflicted mind like ignorance. You might not want to call that an emotion, but it's still sort of misinterpretation, you see. So the action is done with some sort of self-grasping. So even if it's a virtuous action, so it wouldn't have to be necessarily negative, you know. But in a worldly person's mind, they're not thinking of anything, you know, like, I'm trying to be a good Christian, or I'm trying to help people, I'm trying to, you know, get out of cyclic existence altogether. But they do an action which helps, you know, they do an action which is a kind action towards another, but still there's some kind of self-grasping in there, so that without that sort of pure motivation or without the pure dedication, then... that only ripens up as happiness in cyclic existence. So it builds up some kind of merit, you know, some good qualities, and, you know, builds up some sort of good, good outcomes for that person. Might create the cause for them to, meet a good sort of teacher or some sort of enlightened being or something like that. But it's only in itself just creating fortunate ripening experiences in samsara. Yeah. But when you do the action, we're really with the actual motivation of or the actual sort of free from there's no intrusion of self-grasping in the sort of motivating collection, the impulse which makes you do that action, then the ripening effect of that can be leading you out of samsara. If you do the action having, realized emptiness and sort of not having forgotten it, then in the absence of the ignorance, in the absence of the any of those afflicted emotions, then the action has the power to ripen up as something that takes you beyond samsara, you see, just like your pure meditation and emptiness. So the effect of that action is something to break out of samsara. So the contaminant action is one that's, got those sort of things in its causal collection, its motivation. That's how I understand it. Well, I think, when it's a pure, when it's a virtuous action, even in a sort of person who doesn't have any particularly religious thoughts, but they're still, quite happy to help people and do good now and again. So, yeah, they do an action which is kind of compassionate. They feel sorry for that person, or they see how they can help that person and be, take pleasure in the idea of giving that person happiness. So, they help. But that's still, as I say, if they've still got this basic self-grasping or some sort of kind of thing in their mind, even though they've got the virtuous wish to help another person, compassion, then still that action just ripens up in cyclic existence. But as I say, that's not necessarily just a desperate thing, because in cyclic existence you can meet the teacher, or you can build on your present knowledge and sort of have the resources in cyclic existence, the leisure and the opportunities you need to do Dharma practice. Yeah, so contaminated karma and the afflictions, those are the two truth of origins, the two examples I give. So I just got this other definition of happiness somewhere. This one is relevant here. Not so much a definition, but what a Sangha says. So feeling, he's talking about feeling. So that could be happy feeling or neutral feeling or suffering feeling. So those three feelings. Yeah, what we Buddhists restrict feeling, in translations to those three: happy, neutral, or unhappy. So feeling is defined as that which has the character of experience, that is the entity of experience which experiences individually the fruitions that are the effects of virtuous and non-virtuous actions. So when they say, tell me a bit more about feeling, they start using this word experience, which is a very broad word, isn't it? Even in Tibetan, it's like a word which can include all sorts of things. But here we're talking about experience in the sense of you experience something as pleasant, you experience it as unpleasant, you experience it as neither one nor the other. But then he goes on to say, experiencing individually the fruitions that are the effects of virtuous and non-virtuous actions. So for a person taking this Buddhist view really sort of, fully, they see the main cause of your happiness is always, it's a ripening up of some previous virtuous action you've done. And the main cause of feeling suffering at any occasion is, a ripening up of a previous non-virtuous action you've done. So we're always, pointing to the outside, the external object as the source of our happiness or unhappiness, aren't we?
So,
you know, this man comes along and bothers us, so we blame our problem on him. You know, he's the one who's hassling me. You know, so you get annoyed with that person. Or this is the thing that will give me happiness. If I buy this object, then I'll be able to have some pleasant experience with it. You know, so we're always looking at the object as the main source of our happiness, the external thing. But here I say, it's always karma is primarily ripening up in the feeling aggregate. It's ripening up as to throw you into a rebirth, or the karmas are ripening up at death time. But in your lifetime, karma ripens in the feeling aggregate, they say. You see. So your contaminated karma is going to bring you feelings within psychic existence. Feelings within the world. So contaminated phenomena, you know, it's phenomena that are in the kind of, you know, that in that line, that they're produced from, in their causal collection, they have this contaminated karma ripening, and contaminated karma is karma that sort of, you know, has delusion or, you know, afflictive emotion in its sort of, you know, motivation. And those phenomena again lead on to further sort of experiences. They generate further desire and a further aversion, so further negative minds or contaminated minds. So it's those phenomena that are suffering. I'm not saying all phenomena are suffering, you see. So I said I'm just going to read a bit more about that from the text, another couple of paragraphs, then we'll stop for the day, save some for tomorrow. So the way then, number two, yeah, this near to page where it says 365 in the margin, just above that was where we got to. Number two, the way that suffering, the way to know the suffering which is to be known. So that's number one was identifying the suffering, which is to be known. And then number two is the way to know it. So this is the compositional suffering. This is the subtle suffering, which he's saying that is really, you know, the point of meditating on subtle impermanence is to get to know this subtle level of suffering. So this is a point of difficulty. We can understand this from master scholar Tenda Larampa's sorrowful admission. So I don't know who Tenda Larampa is. He's probably some sort of non-Galugpa person who's not quite got the right idea or something. So we should indeed establish suffering through the sign of impermanence. But however much I think about the way to do that, not so much as a hair's worth appears to mind. So, being very honest, I don't know. So I don't know where he's. Maybe he's as a famous teacher in some other tradition. I don't know. Well then, with regard to the way to do it, there are two: general by general and specific by specific. He's talking about a general overview of impermanence, I suppose, and then specific is like gross impermanence and subtle impermanence, just sort of differentiating those two, maybe. So just generally speaking then, general by general. So in the text you've got I, J, K there. I don't think it should be, I think it should be just A and B, you know. General by general is A. Have you got J, K in your text? Or? Yeah, that's a mistake. So general by general is A, and is I, it should be A instead of I, and specific by specific should be B instead of J. And then the next one, K, would be back to A, you see, this is A explained then. So you have to work it out like that. Sorry about that. So general by general. It is as Master Sherub Gochi says, so I presume that's an Indian master. I'm not so familiar with that name either. In the Praise of Superiors, composed by him. Since they are moment by moment and compositional, even the aggregates of the peak of existence are only undesirable. If superiors view them as suffering, what need is there to mention even down as far as the hell realms? Yeah, so the peak of existence, what's meant by that? The aggregates of the peak of existence. Well, that's then we have to do a bit of Buddhist cosmology there. Now we're not considered to be the peak of existence. It's supposed to be the best kind of rebirth to get from the point of view of practicing the Dharma. It's supposed to be like the precious human rebirth. That's the most worth having from that point of view. But from the point of view of how much serenity obtainable within cyclic existence, we're not there. We have quite a lot of suffering, quite a mixture, But if you live in the peak of cyclic existence, that really is, the Beverly Hills of samsara. That's where you really get to bliss out. And you're one of the divine people, like who live in Hollywood, Pardon? Yeah, it is part of the formless realm. So you have the desire realm, which is where we live. Very good name for it, I think that's a good name for where we live, the desire realm. Even Shakespeare didn't come up with as good a name as that. The desire realm. So, and that includes, that includes the hell beings and the hungry ghosts and the animals, then humans, and then the desire realm gods. So I always think of those being like the Greek gods or, those some of the Indian gods, sort of lesser gods who they still do a lot of fighting and have a lot of strong passions like jealousy and emotion, but they also have very, very sort of strong, luxurious sort of sense capacities, don't they? They can drink their nectar all night and, they can never tire, like we get sort of, tired or inebriated after a few drinks, a few hours, but they can go on enjoying themselves, sort of, really long sort of sense experiences. So they have all sort of, superior aggregates to ours, but still within the desire realm, still within cyclic existence, of course. Then above that's the form realm. So they have a kind of these are divine beings who live there, and they say that there is no gross suffering at all, so that their level of rebirth is such that, the deed that ripens to place them in one of those realms is so strong that once you're there, you don't have any, coarse suffering, any gross suffering. You don't have broken legs or pains of birth or, sickness. So you have sort of a very sort of stable level of happiness. But still beyond that, in the end, when you're looking for complete happiness, you say, well, just to have any kind of body, even if it is a more refined and less sort of gross and sort of soggy and sort of heavy type of body as ours, even if you have a sort of a much more rarefied type of body, still even having a body is kind of, some kind of clog, some kind of limitation on your, sort of peace. So there's levels beyond that, which is the formless realm, isn't it? So those are the realms where you don't have any physical manifestation at all, or at least, the very, very slight sort of physical wind your body might ride on, according to tantric teachings. But generally speaking, formless realm means that they're just born as a consciousness. So you have consciousness meditating on, endless space. So you just sort of spread out in your meditation, just meditating on space, very firm, stable level of concentration. These realms are all about concentration, I think, you see. To get there, you have to be very good at meditation. You're very good at concentration, and you reach that level in your meditation of this life, you see, while you're still a human being. And then when you die, you can go to that level of concentration and exist there as one of the beings who is reborn in that level of concentration. So that becomes your life then. So you no longer have a physical body, as I say. On the lowest level, just meditating on pure consciousness, pure space, endless space. But even that becomes sort of too gross a level of object to meditate on. So then you meditate on the next level up, they meditate on endless consciousness. So even says even that's, you know, too heavy a thing to meditate on, and that's too much, you know, that's too gross or something like that. So then you meditate on the next level up, they meditate on endless, I think they meditate on nothingness, don't they? You know, you can't have any object at all, otherwise that will, that just draws you down, brings you down, you know. You're still stuck in some sort of slight level of unsatisfactoriness. So then the one they go beyond that, then it's this level of, you have to meditate on neither being nor non-being, neither existence nor non-existence. And that's the one that's called the peak of cyclic existence. So it's the fourth level of the formless realm. So that's the highest rebirth in cyclic existence, you see. So that's, you know, if you're in cyclic existence, where could you have the most serenity and the least, you know, fluctuations and the least problems? Then it should be there. But if you are a superior being, you see, one who's realized emptiness, then, you know, even that kind of, you know, what to a person like us looking up there from our, you know, our sort of, you know, troublesome life in the desire realm, it looks might look marvelous. But for the superior being who's, you know, realized emptiness directly, who's seen reality, then they look at the peak of existence and see it as just, you know, undesirable, seeing as just something that has no attraction whatsoever. So it's like once you've seen emptiness, you have a completely different perspective on all these things. So I wonder, you know, that you see, I don't know, if you see emptiness, you must see just the unreality of it all. I don't know why. You know, obviously, the cycle of existence is a very in the sense that within the cycle of cyclic existence. So even if it goes on for eons, which it does, it's you have a very long life if you're born there. It's not like just 80 years. It's like you know, eons or something. You'd be born there in this state of stable stasis or serenity or something like that. But still, you know, you're going to come around. So that's the thought of impermanence. So what's the use of being born there? All you're doing is getting stuck there, because once you're there, you don't think about the faults of cyclic existence. You don't think about emptiness, because your mind is just stuck in this state of concentration. So they're saying it's a complete dead end, you see. So you're there for eons, but you can't do anything with that life except just enjoy it. You can't say, aha, now I'm going to get born out of this life. I'm going to go back into, you know, the round of birth and death, take another life, which will no doubt be, you know, I've used up all my meritorious karma getting born to such a high level, so my next life must inevitably be born at a sort of in a worse realm of psychic existence. So what's the use, you know? So that's how the superior being would look at it, I suppose. So it's still impermanent, and you know, it only leads to, you know, in the end it sort of collapses. Like anything else in samsara, it sort of, you know, disintegrates, comes to nothing, comes to ruination. And so you want to be here. You don't want to get stuck there. Absolutely. Yeah. Neither being nor nothing. They say it gets a bit foggy at that point, you know. What actually are you contemplating? And then, you know, here we have the intelligence to think about emptiness properly, and we have the incentive to do it. You know, we're just blissed out in some sort of, you know, marvelous state of being. You're just going through it, you know, suffering. So it goads you on to actually meditate on emptiness. So that's very handy. You know, so you've got a spur of reoccurring suffering. It's useful. But then we have also some leisure. You know, it's not a complete domination by suffering. So we just, of course, for some human beings it is, you know. Some human beings are slaves and they're terribly exploited. So they don't get a chance. But the one with a precious human rebirth, then you've really got something you need to use as quickly, as much as possible. So to say, like, you know, if you're one of these superiors who really kind of seen emptiness directly, your opinion, you know, your the way you see these things must completely change. But let's just read a bit more. There is no need to mention this and that other contaminated splendor. You see that word again, you see, contaminated. It always contains the flaw of its own destruction, you know, the cause of its own destruction. Even such as the aggregates of the peak of existence are not a state conducive to happiness, because moment by moment and through the process of creation and disintegration, their continuum exhausts itself and they connect up with some other suffering, for instance, just like the hell realm aggregates. So they know better than the hell realm aggregates, because, you know, all they're going to do is lead you sooner or later to suffering. If you're not suffering already, then, you know, suffering will, you'll connect up with suffering. So this explains how general impermanence establishes that compounded phenomena generally are suffering. The state which causes superior's revulsion, state not conducive to happiness, an undesirable state, are here all equivalents of suffering, an enumeration of synonyms. So there you've got Gelam Rinpa's idea of whether the measure of something, whether it is suffering or not. Not whether it pleases the drug addict with his heroin, but whether it pleases the superiors or not, you see. So as I said, the superior is somebody who's realized emptiness directly. Even if you realize it inferentially, just using a reasoning, it changes you. You must change your mind completely. Like I was reading this book, what was it called? His Holiness and the Art of Forgiveness or something. Have you read that one? But it's written by Victor Chan or something, one of those journalists who has got friendly with His Holiness and every so often goes and meets His Holiness, and then he puts together a book of all the anecdotes and sort of stories and things he's had, you know, in these sort of travelling a little bit with His Holiness and, you know, having a chance to interview him in his private apartment and so forth. It's really, I think it's that one. Something, His Holiness and the Art of Forgiveness, I think that's what it's called. I was just reading it last week, just picked it up off the shelf in this sort of, you know, this place I was doing a class at. And I didn't get a chance to read it very well. But see, the people like Victor Chan, they're very these expert journalists, so they can really get people to unbutton themselves and to sort of talk about things that, you know, they don't just talk about to anybody. Because they've got this sort of sympathetic way of asking questions and so forth and getting friendly with people. So it's not the first book he's written about His Holiness. But then His Holiness, in that book, he does admit to realizing emptiness and describes a little bit what it was like. Have you come across the book? Yeah. And he says, you know, I was really meditating on, and the self is neither one with the aggregates nor different from the aggregates. So realization of selflessness, kind of first realization of selflessness in this life, you know, comes. Well, that's what he's saying is happening anyway. So, and then he starts talking about, he says then things seem to look like a movie, he says, you know, which I thought was very interesting. He says you can get involved in the story, like we all do, completely involved in the kind of, you know, not able to see the unreality of it, just sort of carried away by, you know, the usual human passions and emotions and kind of, you know, whatever it is that stirs us or limits us or holds us back. You know. But then he says, like when you're watching a movie, you know, you can get involved in it and be very excited or very sorry because the character's having an unhappy time or very happy because, you know, that your side is winning or whatever. And then, you can step back from it and see it as a movie, you know, so you see that it's all just kind of people involved in something which is actually got, it's kind of empty, it's got no kind of, you know, actual nature of being like that. It's just like that because people are taking it like that, or whatever it means to realize emptiness, I don't know. you know, it's all just a projection, right? Yeah, that was, so it's interesting to come across that. It's like we're in a dream, you know. So when we see a dream, beautiful thing, oh, I must have that thing in the dream. But when you wake up, you realize, oh, well, that was just something. I sort of posited the beauty there with my mind. You know? I posited it, its sort of, you know, enticing attractiveness just through the power of my mind. You know, this thing made me very sorry, very unhappy, very sorrowful. But then I projected that, you know, it's just like you posited it from your own side, the fact that it was such a kind of an unhappy experience somehow. So we think we're suffering now, but when we, if it's like suffering in a dream, you know, if you realize emptiness, we realize that the suffering is somehow, you know, something created by our minds. It's not like, doesn't have that real, the fierceness, the real fierce reality of suffering the way we experience it now, does it? So that was his image anyway, his wholeness. He just said, it's a bit like watching a movie. Sometimes you can get involved and, you know, be carried away with emotions. But then if you realize emptiness, then you can see that it's all just somehow kind of, it's actual true nature is somehow the ultimate reality. That's all just kind of not quite like that. Peaceful, you know. So who knows? So if somebody's realized, you know, reality, realized ultimate truth, realized something so deeply, then even this idea of being blissed out as one of these gods who's got, you know, supreme sort of powers of enjoying this and that, you know, sensual experience, just to them it's just like, you know, why are they distracting themselves with that kind of, you know, lesser kind of experience when they need to get out of cyclic existence? So that it causes a superior revulsion to see people, you know, just content with that kind of existence, as if that's you know, the best they're capable of, when we've all got this sort of Buddha potential and, you know, this potential to bring our hearts to peace and rest. So that's how the superiors might look at it. Okay, so we'll leave the text there for the time being then. Maybe we should meditate a bit on suffering. So we've got, he's trying to get at this subtle level of suffering, you see. Although he's talking generally about impermanence, generally about how you withdraw from cyclic existence. So it's not just withdrawing from what ordinary people would say is that there's a suffering part, but you have to withdraw from cyclic existence altogether, you know, sort of forsake the world entirely. But then, of course, if you are bodhisattva, you know, the bodhicitta, you are the person who's really working for the benefit of beings, in the end you don't sort of withdraw from cyclic existence and run away from it and find that place where you are, you know, free from the compulsion to take rebirth. You don't just go as quickly as possible to that place where you are sort of stepped off the round of existence. No, because you keep coming back in order to be of use to others. You don't sort of seclude yourself away in that suspended place, nirvana, solitary nirvana. No, you keep on coming back to the world to help and to be a benefit to others. But still, you've got to have that strong sense of renunciation, that strong sense of, you know, you want to have done with cyclic existence. You're prepared to be here, but you don't want to take part in you know, the games of cyclic existence, because they only lead to more suffering. You're only here to be a benefit to others and help them, you know, sort of progress along the path. So it's all about, you know, getting really great sort of faith or confidence in what we're really capable of, you know, so we can leave all this behind if we know, if we really sort of ascertain that there's a, you know, alternative, that there's a different way of going, you know, carrying on. That's very hard to sort of, you know, persuade ourselves of, isn't it? Cyclical existence is all we know. You know, when somebody starts criticizing a happiness, saying, "Oh, your happiness in cyclical existence, that's not real happiness, you know, that's just suffering," then we don't know what to think, because what other happiness do we know? You see? So, well, you know, don't take our happiness away from us. It's all we've got, sort of thing. So we have to think about, you know, what establishes our Buddha nature, what establishes, you know, the pattern of samsaric rebirth, and how you break that pattern, and how things like meditation on impermanence and emptiness are kind of really are antidotes, so that you overcome your desire, your sort of attachment to such an extent that you even are able to, you know, refrain from this sort of compulsive addiction and desire, attachment to samsaric life. So, looking at Tsongkhapa's presentation of suffering then in the Lamrim Chenmo, so the great stages of the path of enlightenment, he's not just talking about compositional suffering, which is, and you know, the sort of more subtle types. He's trying to give you the complete overview. If you strive to
I was born, and then it kind of goes up to now, whereas if you can kind of keep yourself a bit.
Sure.
Just to complicate me.
Okay. That's fine. Hello. Thank you.
So, you know, we've got to sort of develop this mistrust of cyclic existence altogether. Chandragoming, you who whirl constantly in cyclic existence, yet who enter a happy realm mistaking mere calm for happiness, you will certainly wander helplessly through
hundreds of things like yes.
Are kind of, you know, mistaking some very limited thing for, you know, fulfilling happiness, stable happiness. So then if you look at the kind of sufferings that he's talking about, maybe we should meditate on these few of these kinds of suffering now. And then go back to impermanence and so on tomorrow. So you've got a collection of 8 types of suffering, then you've got a collection of 6 types of suffering, and then a collection of 3 types of suffering in here. The 3 are the ones we've already mentioned: suffering of suffering, suffering of change, and pervasive compositional suffering. But maybe we should take a look at the 8 types of suffering. But each of those have many divisions, so I don't know how many of them we can meditate in one session, really. But maybe we can do a sort of a glancing meditation at them. So let's meditate on, let's say, the 8 types of suffering. So, just to give you them before we start: the suffering of birth, suffering of old age, suffering of illness, suffering of death, suffering of encountering what is unpleasant, suffering of separation from what is pleasant, and the suffering of not getting what you want, and the suffering of the five appropriated aggregates. So these are, a lot of those are sufferings which are very obvious. We don't need a much, not so difficult to reason about, you know, they're pretty obvious, but maybe difficult to get a feeling about, but let's try. So first of all, just breathing meditation, and then thoughts about refuge and generating compassion. So let your body relax. Back straight if possible. And all the other places where you get tension, try to make sure they're all just tension free. Just breathe for a few moments, not having to think about anything at all, just gathering the mind. turning our minds towards enlightened beings, being open to their influence, the beings who've gone before, they were like us, had a simple, you know, embodiment in samsara, but they meditated on the truths, they opened up the path, they showed the way, they've gone to bliss. We remain, but they are summoning us, they are finding the ways to teach us, to inspire us. So if we turn our minds towards them, then their kind of influence, the power of their wisdom itself can help us at least to subdue our or negative thoughts, our distractions, and at the same time inspire us by bringing out our good potentials, getting our good karma to ripen, so we can have a clear meditation. So purifying our obstacles, ripening up our good qualities, so the light, their blessings, pull down upon us. Also take refuge in the Dharma, the real refuge. This is the actual means by which we can achieve our aspiration, turning away from what leads to suffering and taking, definitively getting onto the path which leads to enlightenment. It's the Dharma that is the actual refuge here. Finally, the Sangha, the third of the three jewels of refuge, the superior beings, those who are committed to the path and won't reverse, have seen emptiness directly, seen really clearly our predicament and the way out, and they're also objects of refuge. Now a verse on compassion, a verse to set our motivation, our aspiration to the highest level. Those hapless, wandering beings, my mothers all, I think how often they have cherished me. So like fond mother for her darling child, bless me to feel compassion uncontrived. So at some point, or other, all these mother beings, all the beings that share this realm with, this world with, all of them, you know, who's to say that this person or that person has never helped me, never been kind to me in a previous existence? I do well to think of all of them as my mothers, having been my mothers at one time or another. But, they wander from life to life, from port to port, crossing the ocean without finding the, ever getting to their destination. So bless me to feel compassion for those beings and work for their freedom, work for the means to secure their happiness. And make that my main goal, that we get to enlightenment for the sake of being able to do that.
the Buddha's blessing as we make this our aspiration. Every encouragement. So let's try to cultivate this sort of dark vision of samsara, this this view that sees it as what it is, as a place of limitation, place of frustration. If we have the potential to become Buddha, then we can do. We can find a way out of this oppression, find a way out of these. Dullness, bewilderment that we seem always to be mixed up with. And acute suffering arises again and again. We can see so obviously from the experience of beings we're sharing this world with that suffering is never far away, even if we are temporarily having good conditions. So the first four contemplations are birth, aging, sickness and death. So we just think a little bit about birth. Birth is suffering because, you know, it's painful for those involved. Dangerous. Born here, we're born with dysfunctional tendencies, says Tsongkhapa. So that means we're born with a mind that's you know, got these potentials of the afflicted minds are kind of habituated in our mind, so that it's ready to manifest as soon as we awake into the world and start experiencing it. You know, as soon as we awake from the sort of non-manifest state of being in the womb or being, you know, coming out of the state of innocence into the, you know, the state where we begin to experience the world again, then we have so many dysfunctional kind of states of mind that are just primed, you know, just ready to meet an object and to be generated and see the world in a kind of distorted way and act upon that, get carried away by it. So many of these potentials in our mind when we're born into this world again. Birth is suffering because it is the origin of suffering, in the sense that wherever you take birth in the three realms, desire realm, form realm, formless realm, wherever you take birth, then following from birth inevitably is old age, it's illness, death. So that's just a natural outcome. The way we're born, it cannot sustain. It's like a temporary sort of accumulation of a body thrown by a particular karma that always has a limited lifespan. Then there's the suffering of old age. It's like most humiliating when your handsome body begins to deteriorate. If you live that long, or if you really just say you've got old, then your faculties degenerate. You have to strain to hear what people say. And then your posture, your body itself, the strength of your muscles gets weak. And you can't stand up straight anymore. And your appearance changes. So you don't look, the lines of your face and the wrinkles, the hair becoming white. All your youth is stolen away from you. Then there's the suffering of illness. And one verse says, just as we human beings oppress animals and take advantage of them, so illnesses in turn oppress us, treat us just like we treat animals. They afflict us, they drive us, they oppress us. And in the end, they take us away. So the oppression of the physical illness in turn causes mental anguish, mental disappointment, mental frustration. Things that were previously pleasing and desirable, like good food, we no longer take an interest in. Instead, we have to take very unpleasant tasting medicines, go through medical procedures, which the procedure itself is a pain and a torture. Never mind, it's trying to cure us, but it's oppressive in itself. disease, our old age, have eaten away at us, and eventually we have to go through the suffering of death. We separate from those dear possessions that we have, our possessions and our property. We have to leave all that behind, even though we spent many hours, great hardship, accumulating those things. Dear ones, we have to say goodbye to them, or we're taken away before we have a chance to say goodbye, separating from those whose company we've enjoyed so much, or in the support of our lives. Even our body that we spend so much time trying to pamper, or trying to, you know, things like slavish attention to the needs of the body. Nor can the body accompany us through the death process. Even that must be left behind. Again and again, in our coursing through psychic existence, we have these general sufferings of we're always going to, sooner or later, be encountering what is unpleasant. It's always going to be the case that we have to separate from what we do find pleasant. Whatever we find that is worth having in samsara, so we think, you know, then we have to give it up. Just like that, many times we search, we seek, we make great effort to achieve something, but we don't get what we want. The farmer sows his field, but you know, adverse conditions, he's unable to reap the harvest. Engage in hard work and business, but then don't make any profit. last of these eight divisions is the suffering of the five appropriated aggregates. So aggregates appropriated, it means aggregates, you know, that we take up, aggregates that, you know, on our basis, our mental and physical basis, and we take them up under the influence of our karma and affliction. Mainly talking about our body, you know, we take the body up through control into new rebirth by the ripening of a karma. But then what that body does is sort of, you know, limit or determine what kind of shape or what kind of, you know, potential our mind has. So once you're in the body of a sparrow, then you don't have the mind of a sparrow. So our mind then becomes very much determined by the bodily basis it is riding on. So the aggregates, you know, the whole five aggregates get determined by karma and affliction. And so when something is primarily or, you know, forcefully emerging out of, you know, interaction of karma and affliction, contaminated karma, then suffering is assured. Happiness is, you know, temporarily there, maybe, but it's not going to last. So the aggregates then become just, you know, the basis for many unwanted, unsatisfactory, you know, experiences. Both in this life and then creating the causes for to experience them in a future life. Taking further kind of creating further karmic outcomes still within samsara.
So the word this book uses is disenchantment. Really, we have to end up this meditation with a disenchantment with psychic existence. We determine not to be fooled by it. And we have pleasure there. Yes, we enjoy the pleasure, but not in any attached way, as if in an unrealistic way. Thinking, this is the way to live. You know, this is the happiness I'm looking for. But always with that sense of reserve, you know, you see the faults of psychic existence are too strong for that kind of happiness to be, you know, stable basis, something you really kind of rely on as a lasting benefit, as a refuge. Impossible. And a disenchantment with psychic existence, detachment from its attraction.
Although, that kind of, you know, it's not a disadvantage, that's a great advantage. Then your mind really turns strongly towards the liberation. The Buddha taught a way out of all that, a way of complete sort of realization, beyond any traces of, you know, any traces of self-grasping, or any traces of dissatisfaction whatsoever. So we have to try and understand this situation very well, exactly. And then when we've understood it, we must, you know, really analyze and develop a strong path of meditation, which, thinking about these things again and again in the correct way, and then really brings a powerful transformation to our mind. Transformation comes, then every challenge we have, every problem we have, every dissatisfaction in samsara, then can be turned into, you know, something turned into the path. We can, you know, real perspective, a real way of dealing with samsara's challenges. All the things that happen to us, we can change into, you know, we can use this to develop our mind that's intent on the path all the more strongly. Let's determine to take every obstacle we meet as you know, part of the path, and then recite our song of the stages of the path to really try and fix these things in our mind. So we should have a paper, song of the stages of the path. So as we're reciting this, we can dedicate our merits towards following this path, as far as it will go. Before the Shakya Lord I bow my head, your form from hosts of perfect virtues born. Your speech fulfills the hopes of boundless beings. Your mind sees as they are all knowables. Maitreya and Manjugo, I bow to you. Our peerless teachers, foremost spiritual sons. The task of all the conqueror's deeds assume. You emanate in play to countless realms. At Nagarjuna Sangha's feet I bow. Earth's ornaments renowned throughout three worlds. You show just as it is the intention of the mother of the conqueror's heart to sound. Atisha homies treasurer who holds the full and flawless fifth instructions for the path of the profound view and vast deeds, passed down well by the two great charioteers. I bow to you, my teachers, with respect. I sing all endless scriptures moved by love. With skillful deeds you show the fortunate, the best approach which leads to liberty. Of all earth's learned ones, crown ornaments, their fame a banner shining for four beings, from Nagarjuna Sangha down in line. This graded path the Buddhahood has passed. It yields all creatures' wishes without fail. A prized instruction like a powerful king, collecting myriad streams of splendid texts. An ocean too of glorious eloquence. Now all his speech is contradiction-free. All scriptures see as personal advice. The intention of the conqueror fight with ease. Save from the chasm of the great mystery. So who with sense will not be captured by the three beings' graded path supreme advice, adhered to by the many fortunate, the learned ones of India and Tibet, for certain to explain or hear but once, this essence brief of scriptures all accrues, vast benefit of teaching, listening to true Dharma, contemplate its meaning. Correct and strong reliance in thought and deed upon a spiritual guide who shows the path. No wisdom, root cause, well propitious for all excellence of this and future lives. Though life may be the cost, delighting with the offering of doing what he says. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Far finer than a wish-fulfilling gem, this life with leisure found, but now this once, so hard to find, soon lost, a lightning flash. Reflecting in this fashion, realize well, all worldly deeds are but as winnow chaff. So always seize its essence day and night. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Not sure death brings no birth in evil realms. Convinced the triple gem believes that fear take steadfast refuge, precepts untransgressed, and also it depends on this thick well, on actions black and white and their effects, then do or cast aside as should be done. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Form well and now to win the highest path. Till that is found, there's no progressing far. Train in its cause, there's nothing incomplete. Its vital fluid, all soiled with wrongdoing stains, be cleansed not least of karmic hindrances. Be always keen to use the four paths. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, yearn for freedom, do the same. Unless you strive to know true suffering's false, no genuine urge for freedom grows thing too. On origin, samsara's causal stage, if not, you won't know how to cut its root. So then despair of and renounce the world, or keen to know what binds you to the round. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. A waking mind, a great way center post, support and base for mighty ways and deeds, elixir making both collection gold, a merit hoard of countless virtues must. The hero conqueror children, knowing this, make that most precious mind their inmost bond. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. The wishing jewel of giving grants brings hopes, fine blade that cuts the knot of meanness through. This conqueror children's deed is source and base, have dauntless courage, far resounding fame. The wise ones knowing this, the good partake of giving body, wealth, and virtues all. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Its waters cleanse away misconduct stains. Its moon rays soothe afflictions, feed the pangs. Superb like Nero midst a myriad beings who all bow down to that no power can daunt. Morality in the noble knowing this, adopt it well and guard it like their eyes. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Forbearance, best adornment of the strong, the perfect means to bear affliction's sting. Garuda to the snake of hate opposed, strong arm against the weapon of harsh words. So knowing this, be trained in always in the armor of forbearance unsurpassed. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Attired with steady, ceaseless diligence, your insights and your scriptural knowledge grow. Wax like the moon, your acts all purposeful. Whatever work succeeds as you intend, the conqueror children knowing this cut off. A laziness with forceful diligence, I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Then concentration, sovereign all the mind, when placed like Meru, never wavering, send forth it takes a virtuous object's all, to body and mind great bliss of piety brings. Great yogis knowing this resort to it, to quell love for destruction at all times. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. And wisdom, I sing suchness most profound, path to extract samsara's very root, the source of excellence in scripture praised, most famed of lands to lift confusion's gloom. A wise who yearn for freedom, knowing this, with every effort generate that path. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. One-pointed concentration by itself, we don't see how can cut samsara's root. Nor wisdom lacking calm abiding's power, dispel afflictions much though it may probe. So mount the wisdom settling how things are, upon unwavering calm abiding steed. Wide wisdom then probe well with its sharp sword, a maiden's middle way beyond extremes. Destroy all objects of extremist views, and so make insight into suchness vast. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. With concentration from what need to say, one point of focus plus discernment that precisely approves the concentration grows, that's fixed unwavering on the mode of being. Amazing, who sing this strive to achieve, united, calm, abiding, and insight. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. Praise those who dual voidness cultivate, in equipoise the space like voidness and post-meditation the illusion like. By wisdom joined with method then perfect, the conqueror children's deeds the fortunate, sing this to rest content with partial powers. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. supreme great vehicle, particles and effect, both need the common path that practiced well, save guidance from an expert pilot take, and sail a tantrous set's last ocean o'er. Heed all the pith advice make meaningful, the leisure and endowments you've obtained. I too, a yogi, practiced in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, do the same. In order to acquaint my mind with it, and serve those others with good fortune too, I have explained in plain and simple words the hope are pleasing to the conquerors. Pray all my greatest by this virtue be not parted from the excellent pure path. I too, a yogi, made prayers in this way. You too, who yearn for freedom, make the same.
So just dedicate our merits. Enlightenment for the sake of all. Long life for the gurus. For any of our near and dear ones, anybody particularly we have a karmic connection with, the suffering, we dedicate the merits to those people. Relief of their distress or problems. And then for something good for Tibet, prolonged crisis there. So wish for human rights, improvement in the situation in Tibet. If you're listening, already finished a bit late. So think about that toast of marmalade. Suffering or happiness, both or neither.